Welcome to the Bicast, the podcast by and for our community, the bisexual community. In this segment, we'll be talking about the power of the written word and its use in changing our community and how we are viewed. Today, I'm Becca.
And I'm Walter.
So we have Walter Thomas Beck, poet, writer, activist, and co-host on the Rainbow Asylum, which we will give you a link to. So Walter, tell us a bit about yourself and what you do.
Member, former camp counselor, and just, I guess, all around bad motherfucker.
Sounds like
can I say that?
Of course, you can say whatever you like. But yeah, it sounds like you're fairly interesting, so this is going to be fun. Okay, so we're going to start off, and we'll talk about, first of all, your experiences as a bisexual, if you don't mind. We'll start off just... tell us how you came to the realization of your sexuality. How old were you? How long has it been? All that kind of thing. Just give us a background on you.
Just a background on my bisexuality?
Yeah, that'd be great.
I probably came to the realization of it. I don't know, I was around 13, 14. You know, that's when I started knocking one out, if you get what I'm saying. Hoisting the banner and fucking A and telling everybody, oh yes, come out, you know, be yourself, and here I was keeping my own secret. I had my reasons, like most people do. The main reason was I was absolutely terrified of losing my job. At the time, I was a camp counselor. I worked for one of the local Boy Scout camps. I'd been a counselor, at that point, about 8 years or so. Loved the job. Miss it every day. And at the time, especially, the BSA was officially very, very hostile to LGBT people. And I was willing to put myself through hell to keep the job. Which, if there's any psychiatrists listening to this show, they're probably putting me on a fast track to therapy for admitting that on the air. But, you know, and toward the end, it really did eat at me. I mean, you know, granted, I've always been, you know, one to enjoy a drink now and then, but, you know, I can't believe I'm admitting this, but you told me to be honest, you know, all that stress of the years and years and years and years and years was eating at me, and the only way I knew how to deal with it back then was to drink. And when I say I drank to deal with it, you know, I mean, I was going out, having, you know, 6, 7, 8 draft beers at the bar, coming back to the hotel I was living at the time, and drinking cheap gutter wine and straight grain alcohol, you know, because I didn't want to deal with it. You know, I wasn't drinking to have a good time. I was drinking because I didn't want to deal with any of this.
Yeah, didn't want to think or feel. Would that be a good description of that particular...
I'm sorry, what?
Didn't want to think or feel.
Yeah, oh God, yeah. You know, and hell, you know, my buddies finally cornered me. And, I mean, they all basically said, and this is going to sound, I guess, cliched, melodramatic as fucking hell, but this is how it happened. You know, they all basically, enough, you know, you're coming out because we're not going to sit here and watch you kill yourself. I mean, you know, shit, my buddy Chris came up to a room one night. You know, came in, and I was so out of it and fucked up. I mean, I had no idea where I was. I really, you know, I was, you know, rambling incoherently, sobbing, just totally out of control. I mean, he physically grabbed my keys and locked up the rest of the booze because he was worried if he didn't, I was going to drink until I didn't wake up. So then I made a very hard phone call to home. You know, called my old man, and, you know, it was... He could tell something was wrong. I mean, I'm not good at hiding shit. I'm really not. One of those guys, you know, where's my heart on my sleeve, so to speak. And he was like, son, what's wrong? What's wrong? And I said, maybe this is something, you know, we should talk about, you know, next time I'm home. No, just tell me what's wrong. So I finally stammered it out. I said, Dad, I swing both ways. And he was like, what? I'm bisexual. I like both. I'll never forget what he said. You talk about a weight off my chest. And this is, I'm quoting my old man verbatim here. He said, oh, is that all? Oh, well, son, that doesn't mean I love you any less or that I'm any less proud of you. I mean, it was just so accepting. And then it got even better because, you know, I had kind of accepted the fact. It's like, okay, I've come out, that's the end of being a camp counselor. It was a fun run, but maybe I'd rather be a living writer than a dead counselor. Well, about a month or so after I came out, Andrew Bowman, who was a friend of mine in Terre Haute, we had known each other for a long time, we both worked together at the same camp, well, he was a program director that year, and he called me up and he said, hey, Walt, what are you doing this summer? I said, well, I mean, and I told him, like, dude, you know, I don't know, I mean, you know, I've come out, you know, this is kind of the end of it, ain't it? And he told me, once again, I'm quoting verbatim here, you know, he says, Walter, I don't give a shit what National thinks. I don't give a shit what Council thinks. We need you, Cretenstein.
Well, there's not much better support base than that.
Oh, no, you know, so I really had support from everybody. I mean, I ended up working myself up and, you know, nearly killing myself with liquor, but basically over nothing. I mean, I'm glad it turned out that way, but, you know, so, yeah, that's kind of the basic personal history of all that.
Okay, so, yeah, thank you for being so honest about that. That's there's a lot of stories that are similar to that, and I think it's actually really nice. You're, if you don't mind me asking, how old are you?
I'm 27.
You're 27, and so your parents are going to be slightly older, and the fact that they accept it so easily gives, I think it'll give a lot of listeners hope, and I really hope it does, because I'm sat here and I'm actually really happy for you that it turned out that way.
Thank you.
So now we've got that little bit out of the way, I'm going to sort of move on to your activism, because you mentioned being on the picket lines and everything else, but keeping the secret at the same time. So if you want to talk about, I'm going to give you the opportunity now to talk about your bisexual activism, how that started, how that came about, and just generally give us a flavour of it.
Well, I got my start with LGBT activism back in the summer of 2003. I was, 16, an angry punk rock, heavy metal little fucker, definitely politically aware. I mean, I had gotten my start in activism period earlier that year, because, it was during Governor Bush's administration. I'm taking a page from George Carlin. I'm not going to call him President Bush. I'm going to call him Governor Bush.
That's perfectly fine.
But, the Iraq War had started, the Second Iraq War. I had been involved with the anti-war movement, a little bit. Got my first taste of activism, that first taste was really nice, because, like I said, I was 16, full of, hormones, pissed off all the time, needed a direction for it, and like, boom, here's activism, there's a direction for it. Anyway, in 2003, in the summer, the Supreme Court handed down the landmark decision of Lawrence v. Texas, which finally did away with the remaining sodomy laws in the country. I mean, it's hard to believe that just 11 years ago, gay sex was a felony in several states. So that really inspired me, because it's like, wait a minute, this is just now legal? What the fuck?
Yeah.
So that was really the beginning. I didn't really do a lot in high school, because, I was living in a small town, opportunities to demonstrate were few and far between. But once again, when I got to college, that's when I, really got into it. My first LGBT picket was down in Evansville. It's a little town in southern Indiana. It was about a 45-minute drive from Vincennes. City council or whatever, they were debating on whether or not, to have a symbolic vote, to support marriage equality. Now, keep in mind, this was back in 06. The idea of marriage equality in the state of Indiana, shit.
Yeah.
More realistic to, see our governor on an LSD trip, But still, I went down there with some friends of mine. We had the picket line, there was a real rush to it, and in an odd sort of way, it was love at first sight in my case. the activism really amped up when I transferred to Indiana State University in Terre Haute. I spent 2 years in Vincennes and then transferred to ISU, I was on a lot of picket lines in Terre Haute. As my buddy Kyle once said on Facebook, I don't even remember what protest it was, but he made a remark online. He said, "Why is it every time there's a demonstration in town, Walter's picture's in the paper?" I mean, but so like I said, it really amped up when I went to Terre Haute. Although I actually had my first real negative experience with LGBT activism when I was in Terre Haute. I guess this is a true story. It was my first year there. Hold on, I'll light a smoke here. Just a note for the listeners, Becca told me I'd talking for a while, so I definitely came prepared. I got fresh wine and fresh cigarettes, so
yeah.
Keep me moving. But anyway, this was my first year at ISU. It was in April. I was walking to class, and, you know, in the middle of campus, you know, we got a big fountain, and, you know, there's benches around, you know, it's just a place where people sit and hang out and bullshit and all that. And I see these guys setting up for a demonstration. Now, at this point, it had been probably about a year since I'd been on the line, you know, I had the itch. Yeah. And they were setting up for the annual Day of Silence. I don't know if you guys do the Day of Silence in the UK, but, you know, this was the first time I'd heard about it. I guess we missed the memo down in Vincennes. But the Day of Silence, it takes place all across the country. It happens, you know, mostly in high schools and universities. And it's where you pledge to be silent for the day in symbolic solidarity with all of, you know, our LGBT brothers and sisters who are forced into silence, you know, by not being accepted, you dig it. So anyway, so I see these guys setting up for this demonstration for the Day of Silence, you know, and I'm like, well, fuck yeah. So I walk up to them and I'm like, hey, you know, you guys need a hand? I'll help you set up chairs or help you with that table there. Hell, give me a picket sign, man. I'll stand up there, with the tape on my mouth. Fuck it. You know, and they basically told me to go fuck myself.
Oh.
You know, yeah, and here's why. This is where I really started butting heads. Now, you gotta understand, when I was in Vincennes, you know, because I was involved with the university LGBT group in Vincennes. I mean, you know, it's a tiny little university, you know, and we all stuck together down there. You know, it was one for all and all for one. Well, at ISU, the official LGBT group down there was, they were called Advocates for Equality. And they were mainly your middle-class pretty boys, if you get what I'm saying.
Yeah.
They're setting up for this demonstration. You know, they got their polo shirts and their nice trousers and their gelled hair. And here I come walking up, you know, scraggly beard, John Lennon Revolution shirt, you know, looking, you know, like, well, like I do, you know, like a seasoned, you know, fucking street fighter. And they didn't want any gutter trash like me fucking up their party. So, yeah, they told me to get lost.
Well, that's not very nice, is it?
But, it was the first real bad experience I had with any activism within the community. Although, funny postscript to that story, you'll get a kick ass. Once again, this is a true story. A few years after that incident, because that happened in 08, well, 2011 rolls along, and they're getting ready to set up for their Day of Silence thing. You know, it's a couple months before it happens. You know, they're starting their prep work. And, you know, after they told me to fuck off, obviously I didn't want to have anything to do with them. Well, they came up to me, and they said, listen, man, you know, we know, you know, you're basically the best LGBT street organizer on campus, basically in this town. Will you help us out? I thought about it. I wasn't gonna do it. I was gonna tell them to fuck off. But my buddy Aaron, who I was pretty close friends with, hadn't seen him in a while. He lives out in Ohio now. But he came up to me personally and said, Walter, will you please help us out so that we can make it good this year? And I said, you know, dude, since you are the one who asked me, I'll do this. You know, but so yeah, they came crawling back to me.
What are we gonna do? It sounds like you've got an interesting history with it, and you're very capable. And anyone would be mad not to want you walking the picket line with them.
Well, you know, I have to say the most fun I ever had at a demonstration in Terre Haute, and this was probably the most press coverage I ever got to, at least for one single demonstration. Now, fortunately, you guys in the UK never have to deal with these fuckers, because, as I recall, they're legally banned from entering your country. Your government's smarter than ours on that one. But a few years ago, this was back in 2010, the notorious Westboro Baptist Church decided they wanted to pay a little visit to Terre Haute.
I bet you were looking forward to that, weren't you?
Once again, this will kind of give you an idea of the rep I had as an activist. A few months before they were going to show up, I got an email from a friend of mine. You know, and in the email, it was just a copy of their schedule, and she wrote one word, one line. She said, call in the Calvary. So we showed up in full force for that one. That one was fun, although I have to say my buddy Eric beat me when it came to outrageous. He showed up. Have you ever ever seen the movie A Christmas Story? You ever seen that?
I don't think I have personally, but tell us anyway. Our listeners probably have.
Well, there's a scene toward the end of the movie where the kid gets a pair of those bright pink bunny footy pajamas from his aunt. And my buddy Eric shows up to this demonstration wearing a pair of footy bright pink bunny pajamas. And I was like, dude, I gotta admit, you got me beat on that. Although the funny thing about that rally, and this is really gonna make me sound egotistical, but fuck it, I'm the one being interviewed. I'm allowed to stroke myself. Well, not like physically. I mean, I'm not gonna, you know, not gonna subject your listeners to that. But
thank you for it.
We're all waiting for the bastards to show up. You know, all of us are out there, and you know, I got me and my guys. You know, there were some other people from the other universities in town, and you know, had a nice big counter demonstration crowd. Well, the news van pulls up. The news guy gets out of his van with his cameraman and says, "I'm with the press. Who wants to talk to me?" Not making this up. Every fucker there pointed at me and said, "Talk to this guy." Oh, well, put me on the spot. Thanks.
That just proves the kind of backup you had that day. That they were all, you know, they were all willing to let you speak for them. Says a lot about the respect you had.
I let him put his mic in front of me and, you know, said my little piece. That news clip used to be available online, but I don't know if it is or not. I mean, it's been 4 or 5 years ago. So.
Well, if it is, we will find it and we'll put a link to it. If not, and anyone else finds it, please get in touch with us and tell us, because I want to see that.
So, here's a little bit of background on the activism part of me. I've been doing activism, primarily street work, for the last 11 years. I've done pickets all over the state, you know, Indianapolis, Terre Haute, Vincent, you know. One of the downsides I've seen, as our movement has progressed, one of the things I can't say I like, you know, is that the fight is quickly becoming, you know, the battleground for lawyers and lobbyists, and it seems like, in a way, you know, street guys like me are becoming almost obsolete, you know?
Yeah, we don't see a lot of grassroots movement. Speaking of grassroots movement, everything else, you know, we set up the bycast. And you've actually been working with us for a while. We came to you when we were looking for a resident poet, and you were brilliant and agreed to help us out. So I just want to talk a little bit about your work with that now, because we do have some of your poetry on the website already. And there will be links to other stuff, I'm reliably informed by Lynette. So... let's just have a discussion about that, because your poetry is very hard-hitting. Not particularly traditional technically, but you've got a way with words, my friend, you really have.
Well, I would hope I have a way with words. I have a piece of paper and a $40,000 debt that says I do.
Well, that's always a... you should frame that.
For the bycast, I am the official poet, you know, the by laureate,
yep,
if you will. Lynette's posted a lot of my work, some of it explicitly political, some of it not. Poetry, I just kind of stumbled into. In fact, poetry and journalism both I just kind of stumbled into. Because, you know, when I was in high school, you know, I played in a band, you know, I played drums, you know, in a teenage rock and roll band. Yeah, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a musician. You know, and then when I went to college, you know, I mean, Now you gotta remember, I was 3.5 hours away from home, and I grew up in Avon. You know, Avon was all I knew, you know, for my first 18 years. This is what I knew. So I'm 3.5 hours from home. You know, away from all my friends, away from, you know, all the familiar sights. I had really nothing. nothing. You know, not a hell of a lot, at least not at first. That quickly changed, but I had my computer and a stack of CDs, and I put two and two together and started writing, you know. Got into journalism and, you know, started writing some poetry. And at first, you know, my poetry, you know, the earliest stuff I did, obviously, was very, very raw. The only examples, I guess, of my early work that have ever been published, there were two poems published in the 2007 edition of the Vincennes University Tecumseh Review. It was my first publishing credit, and the two poems in there, very, very raw. You know, and then when I transferred to ISU, I transferred, you know, to be a journalism major. That didn't work out because I realized very quickly my professors, you know, they wanted, you know, your traditional objective straight-laced reporter. I'm a gonzo journalist. I am completely subjective. I have no problem ripping whoever I'm writing about a new asshole if they deserve it. So that fell through. So I ended up being an English major, and I needed to declare a minor, so I minored in creative writing and started taking poetry classes. And it was really an eye-opener. You know, the first poetry class I had as an undergrad, like I say, I think this was my first year at ISU. Professor was a guy by the name of Dr. Brennan, and he pulled me aside one day after class and said, "Walter, you're really good. You know, you have a lot of potential here. This is good stuff. But let me show you what you can do with it." You know, so he showed me. You know, because you got to remember at the time, you know, it was my stuff was all in one stanza. It wasn't punctuated, you know, and he showed me, you know, here's how you break it up into stanzas, and here's different stanzas you can break it up into, and here's how you punctuate it, and, oh, here's how to do a sonnet, and here's how to do a villanelle, you know, here's just all these different things, you know, and it was really opening a door for me, you know, so I started experimenting, started writing a bit more seriously, you know, got a lot of shit published in the Tonic, which was the literary journal at ISU. Well, it used to be the Tonic. I think they changed the name a few years ago. It's Illusions now. It's been a few years since I've been involved with it, but you know, and I started performing regularly as well. You know, and you mentioned, you know, my poetry is very, very untraditional, and it is. You know, despite my academic background in studying poetry, you know, it was my degrees in English literature and creative writing. And the main reason for that is, you know, I started out as a musician. You know, I was doing this interview, I think this was last year, a couple years ago, with this arts rag out in Phoenix, Arizona. If for whatever reason I have a big following in Phoenix, my poetry does anyway, which is funny because I've never been to Phoenix. But then again, I have a big following in the UK too, apparently, and I've never been to Britain either, so wherever the fans are.
Well, if you're going to come here, make sure you drop by. I keep saying that, and one day I will get you here.
Have a bake sale.
Yeah, we'll do that.
But anyway, like I said, you know, I was doing this interview with this arts rag, and he asked me kind of a similar question, and I said, well, it's like this. In a way, I don't consider myself a poet. I consider myself a frustrated musician who found a typewriter to be my instrument of choice. I mean, you know, my poetry is very, very rooted, you know, in a music and kind of a rock and roll tradition. And most of my stuff is typed out. I don't handwrite a lot of it for two reasons. A, I have terrible handwriting. And B, you know, since I used to be a drummer, you know, there's a real rhythm to typing out work. You know, it's just like playing the drums. It's just a bit of a different setup, you know. I'm still trying to find that bass rhythm.
Well, that's an interesting descriptor of it. Yeah, but go on.
You know, and it, as far as the performances go, I've had some pretty outrageous performances. I think I'm one of the only people in the history of Indiana State University to ever be banned from campus open mic nights for a poetry performance.
Oh, is that on the internet anywhere?
Well, the performance itself isn't, because it wasn't taped, but there are some photos. What it was, this was hilarious. This was, I think, only the second gig I had ever done on campus, and only my fifth or sixth gig overall. I hadn't been performing live that long. And it was an open mic night at one of the dorms. You know, the RAs put it together because, you know, if you're hired on as an RA, you got to put on programs. So they were like, all right, we'll just do an open mic night. And I went with my friends Kelsey and Pinky, you know, and it was in October. And I'm thinking, okay, well, it's be kind of a Halloween trip. Let's do a little something different. So we did. At the time, I had a pretty long beard. In fact, my beard was so long back then, I used to hide cigarettes in it just to freak people out. Trust me, you know, you see somebody reach into their beard and flip out a cigarette, it makes your day.
Yeah, you'd think it would.
But anyway, so of course, I still have my long hair. I still got my long hair now. My hair and beard were braided. Half my hair was blood red, the other half was lime green. My beard was dyed blue. And I go up there shirtless, and I had "We Die Young" written across my chest in stage blood. For those of you wondering about the reference, that was actually a reference to an Alice in Chains song. You know, and I get up there, and I had on my leather jacket, you know, to cover up my stage blood. And I get up there, whip off my jacket, you know, up there shirtless, you know, stage blood everywhere, you know, ripped jeans, motorcycle boots, you know, grab the mic and, you know, start doing all this, you know, hardcore poetry, you know, about whiskey and blowjobs and revolution. And I mean, the audience, they didn't know how to take it. They really didn't. You know, like, when I finished my set, they just kind of sat there like, what did we just see? And after the show, the RAs who organized it, they came up to me, and it was so funny, you know, they were acting so nervous, you know, like I was going to do the whole Indiana Jones thing, you know, Kali Mons, you know, rip their goddamn hearts out. You know, of course, anybody who knows me can tell you I'm a pretty mellow, relaxed guy anyway. I'm pretty much a pacifist, but, you know, so like I said, you know, they were acting all nervous, you know, they were like, listen. You know, we don't want to censor you or anything, you know, free speech, we totally support it, but, if you could, never perform here again, we would really appreciate it.
Ouch.
So, well, it gets better, you know, because I, you know, obviously I told the guys about it. Of course, you know, the guys, they were all like, oh, hell, you should write a letter to the school paper and raise all kinds of hell about it. I'm like, no. There's no need to do this. All we have to do is let word get around about this. You know, so I did. You know, I let it leak, you know, that I had been banned. Next thing I know, everybody wanted to see my act.
Yeah, because ban something and it's like the standing rule in England here is ban a record and it goes to number one. That's what happens, and it's the same sort of thing. People always want to know what they can't see. It's actually very good timing with the release of the interview, which tells you everything. You know,
oh, yeah.
Tell people they can't see something, and it will they will fight tooth and nail to see it.
They'll find a way. You know, now granted, you know, not all of my performances were that wild. I mean, you know, for me to do, you know, what I call a full Monty show, you know, with the makeup and the stage blood and everything, you know, that generally has to be, you know, like a special booking. You know, it's got to be, you know, I got to have like a special slot or a headliner slot, because that takes effort to do that shit.
Yeah.
You know, and I've done all kinds of shit with it. I tried a new piece of performance art at my last gig. I had a gig here in Indianapolis. It was my first Indianapolis show since 2012. What can I say? That's the thing. If you're a musician, it's easy to get a booking, man. You're a poet. Good luck.
Yeah.
You know, not a lot of venues, but over at the Irving Theater, which is where I do, it's where we do Rocky Horror, one of the other guys in the Rocky crew with me hosts an open mic night. I think he does his every week. And he had been after me for a while, you know, to come out and perform. I said I would. And a few weeks ago, I went out, did the gig. He gave me a headlining slot, 45 minutes, get up there and do it. You know, so I went full Monty. You know, I had the makeup, I had the stage blood. I think I had an anarchy symbol done on my chest with the stage blood for that one. You know, and I had on a pair of these trousers. You know, people are fucking envious of these. They're denim. They're white tight denim that are custom painted. They were custom made for me by an artist friend of mine. Those are a pair of my stage trousers. He did three different pairs for me. I got a pair that's the black and white ones, and I got a pair in leopard print, and I got a pair in blood red. So yeah, he did my stage clothes for me. My buddy did. But anyway, toward the end of the last set. I'm doing my last piece, and it's really a cool poem. I'll send it to you.
Okay.
And it has a really good chanting rhythm to it. I mean, you know, if you just read it on the page, you don't get the full experience. This is one of those pieces that's meant to be seen live. You know, it's got a really good chanting refrain to it. You know, the refrain is, you know, this used to be a forest and everything was free. You know, you get, so I had the audience, you know, chanting at it toward the end, you know, and the whole piece, it's a satire on American consumerism and American capitalism. So I have the audience chanting this rhythm, getting really, really into it, and I reached into my back pocket and threw two handfuls of $1 bills into the crowd.
Okay. It's an interesting statement to be making while chanting about capitalism.
Everybody scrambles to grab the money, and then after I sat back down after my set ended, you know, a lot of them were looking at me like, and they all asked, they were like, can we keep this? I'm like, yeah, throw it in the crowd, it's yours, keep it, burn it, give it, you know, buy a homeless guy a drink, you know, it's yours. If I wanted it back, I would have used Monopoly money.
Yeah.
You know, so,
So, yeah, now, if you send us that, we will definitely link it along with this interview, because that sounds like well worth a watch, so...
Well, there's no videotape of it, but the gig was audio taped, like, on a fucking cassette, because I don't have a digital recorder. But that gig and another headlining gig I had back in July will be transferred... To a digital format, and they will be released as my new live album.
Well, do let us know when you're releasing that, and where we can get that album, and we'll definitely make sure anyone who's interested has that information.
Oh, definitely. Now, narrowing it down a little bit, you know, that's just kind of my poetry in general. I have to give a lot of credit to the LGBT poetry scene. You know, they were really the first literary scene to embrace my work, to kind of break me out, you know, of Terre Haute, give me a bit of a national audience. You know, I'm to say that I've been featured in two issues of Assaracus, which is a LGBT poetry journal released by Sibling Rivalry Press. They're one of the biggest poetry journals in the country right now. They featured my work in two issues. A few years ago, I was featured in an anthology called Among the Leaves, which is an anthology of male Midwestern queer poets. That was released through Squares and Rebels Press, based out of Minnesota. A lot of critics in the gay literary scene have reviewed my various chapbooks that have come out over the years. They've really embraced my work, and I have to say that right there was probably one of the biggest shockers of my life, you know, as a writer anyway, because, you know, my first book came out a couple years ago. It's called Life Through Broken Pens. It's currently out of print, but they are doing a special re-release of that, along with my second book, As the Cannons and Muskets Roar. That'll be available hopefully in the spring. I'll send you guys a link for that when that's available. But anyway, when my first book came out, I was talking to a guy by the name of Ray Luzak. He's a poet based out of Minnesota. He's a gay male poet. In my opinion, one of the best poets alive in the country today. You know, he's fucking good. Ray's been doing poetry, fuck, almost as long as I've been alive, you know. So I asked him, I said, hey, you know, my first book came out, and, you know, do you know of any critics, you know, who would review this? Because, you know, since I was signed with an independent publisher, I mean, I've had to do all my own press, which I don't mind. I'm a fucking loudmouth. I can go out there and promote my own shit, you know. And Ray was like, yeah, let me give you a couple names. And, you know, he sent me the contact information for a few critics, and, you know, I sent him the book. And, you know, and I'm thinking, I'm like, okay, you know, this is my first book. The best I can expect, you know, the best that's going to happen is, you know, these critics are going to say, you know, well done for a first effort. It's not bad. It's not great. The kid shows a lot of potential. We'll look and see what he has to offer in the future, right? No, every single one of these critics, when they reviewed my first book, they all basically said, where the fuck has this kid been hiding?
Well, having read your work, I can agree with that.
I mean, you know, it just blew me away. I'm like, holy shit. You know, so definitely a lot of credit to the queer literary scene for really breaking me out, you know, finding me an audience. In fact, I got to do my first out-of-state gig I ever did, thanks to the gay literary scene. This was back in 2011. I had a piece published in Off the Rocks. It's an annual anthology put out by Newtown Writers up in Chicago. And, you know, I got the acceptance. Like, yeah, you know, we're going to publish your poem. Congratulations. They're like, oh, fuck yeah, that's great. And then, like, a month later, I got an email from the editor, you know, Allison. I forget her last name right now. I'll think of it after the fucking interview's over, and I'll be like, damn it. Anyway, she shot me an email. She was like, listen, I really like your stuff. We're going to be having a showcase at Printers Row Lit Fest, which is one of the biggest literary festivals in the country. Would you like to come and perform at our showcase? Well, fuck yeah! You know, so I got a chance to go up to Chicago back in June 2011 and perform on this big stage, you know, with all these, you know, really poets who are far bigger than I am. You know, and I have to admit, I'm not much for stage fright, at least not anymore. You know, in my first couple years doing gigs, I used to get so nervous I'd almost puke. You know, but by the time 2011 rolled around, you know, I had done a lot of gigs, you know, felt pretty comfortable on stage. Not up there, God, I was so nervous I was almost pissing myself, you know.
Wow.
You know,
wow.
But you know, I'm happy to say, you know, like I said, you know, I got up and I did the set. I didn't have a long set. I only had like a 10-minute long set. You know, it was just a showcase. You know, when I first got up there, it was at a podium. And normally when I perform live, I hate podiums because they're too restrictive. You know, I like a mic stand. I can pick up a mic stand and, you know, mosey around. I can't do that with a podium. But I was glad they had a podium that day. I mean, and you can look from the pictures, you know, of me up there. The first poem or two, I have this thing in a fucking death grip. But by the end of my set, I had that entire packed crowd on their feet. I mean, I conquered Chicago. It was great.
Yeah. So, anyway, now you've given us the background into your poetry, what I'd like to do, just flagging this for listeners who might not think, I have a bit of a literary background, so I'm going to sit here and I've picked out a couple of your poems that we've got on the website, so people can actually go ahead and read this so they know what we're talking about. I'm just going to sit here and ask you to geek out a little bit with me over some of your poetry. Because your imagery is... I have read a lot of hard-hitting stuff. The fact that I'm doing this interview, because I have that background in very hard-hitting poetry. Your work is... You know, I won't say it gave me nightmares, because it didn't quite, but it sticks in the mind, it really does. I'm looking at here. On the website, the three I will recommend, especially for this... I will recommend Divine Verdict, Coattail Rider Blues, and what we have called Still Exiles or Freedom, Burn Down the Last Door. And your work is... There's no... I'm sat here, I can sit here and talk technicalities about imagery and similes and metaphors and all the rest of it, but I won't do it justice. I'm going to say to people, make sure you know, read this, like, literally pause this podcast, go read those poems, because these will really, I think these give the best, there's nothing like your work to advertise your work. And I was hoping you'd honour me and let me geek out a little bit over your poetry with you, because not often I get to do that with the actual author of a piece of work or the poet.
Oh, please do.
I just sort of, you seem, I mean, obviously you said you've got the literary background, but you're very well read as well. There's hints of, you know, I'm a history major, so the fact that you, especially in Divine Verdict, you go through all the history, you know, the dark side of American history, and that you know so much about. I learned about things in history from reading this poem. I went and researched things in this poem. So that was
history for American history particularly. That's one thing I can thank my old man for. You know, he instilled in me an early age a love of history and a love of reading. You know, he's told me, you know, one of the things he's most proud of as a father was instilling a love of reading in me at an early age. And he's right, I never go anywhere without a book. So, you know, I have, obviously I didn't major in history, but I have, I guess, kind of an amateur background in history, as it is, particularly American history. You know, I'm also a Civil War reenactor, so I kind of experience it in a unique way, so to speak. So, yeah, you know, I have the history background.
Yeah, I mean, your knowledge of just picking out things from this poetry, you know, even just the first... You do go chronologically through time as well, which I like in this poem, because there's not this jumping around, and I do like that, because it reads like, I hesitate to say it, but in England we joke that your Declaration of Independence, it's not a state document, it's a rap sheet. What it is, you read it, it reads like a rap sheet for the king at the time. But where that fails to really evoke the feeling of what they're talking about, I think you really hit it on the head, and I don't know whether it's your style of writing or the form that you've chosen, but it's just talking about, you know, these millions of civilians killed overseas, and you don't just talk about American losses, which I really like. In fact, you've gone the complete opposite of that. And sort of... I don't want to say that you paint America as the bad guy, because you don't. Because the fact that you are American yourself sort of gives this whole... This poem in particular a very satirical edge. And then the final line, obviously, of you spend something like five or six stanzas at least, one, two, three, four, five, six, seven stanzas talking about what God won't judge. And then this final had just this one line on its own, but God will judge America for two grown men kissing. And that, I can imagine hearing that read in sort of in an audience and just standing up and just cheering, because it's a real rallying cry, and your poetry is very good at that. You are very good at that.
Well, you'll have a chance to hear the audience reaction to that piece, because I did perform that poem at my most recent show, the one that was taped, the one that will be released. And outside of the historical background, that poem was a direct response, you know, and definitely has a dark satirical edge to it, no doubt of that, as a lot of my poetry tends to have. No offense, I have been told I have a rather British sense of humor, so...
Oh, no, I do sort of find some of the things... You've got that way of turning... It's a very spitting image kind of sense of humor, if there's any British listeners who understand that. Spitting Image was a 1980s TV program. I think they're actually talking about bringing it back. I hope they do. Where they essentially created puppets of famous people of the day, the great and the good, the rich, essentially, and the politicians, and acted out satirical sketches with them. There's just typing, if you want to know about this, just type in YouTube Spitting Image Margaret Thatcher. Do not do that if you like Margaret Thatcher. You will be offended. And I wouldn't want you to be offended. I wouldn't want anyone to be offended. But, you know, if... You know, and there were no holds barred on Spitting Image. Nothing was sacred. And I think... But there was an undercurrent of morality and ethics that... You have that same tone and that same... depth, I think, is a way of putting it. I'm sat here, I'm talking to a poet that I admire, and I'm starting to blabber a little bit, but yeah, it's
right. Well, like I was saying, the poem, the bit for the poem, like I said, it was written in a direct direct response to a lot of the political rhetoric you hear in this country from the right. And unfortunately, living here in the Midwest, I mean, you know, I am the token liberal in a lot of ways. I mean, you know, living here, you know, you deal with the Bible-thumping preachers and, you know, the conservative politicians kissing their ass, and, you know, and you hear that a lot. You know, we have heard, you know, oh, God's judgment is coming because we're not allowed to beat up gay people in public anymore. We've basically heard that for the last 10 years, you know, so I don't remember what specific incidents sparked the poem, but, you know, I just started thinking about that. I'm like, well, now, wait a minute. If God is going to judge America, let's look at some shit maybe God should be judging us for.
Yeah, well, you hit the nail on the head with that one. You really did. I couldn't... Taking that, I don't think there is... I don't think I've read anything with that particular aim that's done it as well as you've done it here. I really don't. But I'm conscious, A, of time, and B, of boring anyone who's not got the literary background. But you, what I was hoping to sort of illuminate with all that was how you really do take your writing, express yourself, and your writing is so powerful, and it is as much a part of the fight as standing on picket lines, raising banners, marching, all the rest of it. Because this touches people in the quiet moments. And I was wondering if you had anything to say about that as well.
What, the relationship between my art and activism?
Yeah.
Well, you know, activism and art have always gone hand in hand. I mean, you know, I mentioned my music background. You know, if you listen, I mean, you know, a lot of the old protest songs that came out of the 60s, I mean, you know, Jefferson Airplane's Volunteers, Buffalo Springfield, For What It's Worth, you know, The Doors, 5 to 1. You know, these are great songs, you know, that have outlived and outlasted the movements that they were inspired by. You know, people still remember the songs, and people still use the songs, you know, for their intended purposes. Shit, I've been on a picket line more than once when somebody was cranking out, you know, Jefferson Airplane's Volunteers, or, you know, Bob Dylan's Blowing in the Wind.
Yeah, there's not many places you can go, if, especially in protests where you don't hear CCR, to go a little bit later in music history, but, yeah. I know exactly what you mean. I was planning on writing a dissertation on it, but apparently music's not academic enough. I'm not going to get into that. but, yeah, I do like, you said, you know, you're what was it you said? You're a frustrated musician with a typewriter, which is really good. And That does come across, and like I said, I'd love to, you know, put some backing tracks to some of your work, because that they're rallying cries. They're what people should be, you know, singing and or chanting as they're marching for whatever protest that particular piece of poetry fits.
You know, and speaking of, you know, my statement that, you know, I'm a musician with a typewriter. You know, a prime example of that, you know, one of the poems on the site, one of the ones I believe you mentioned, Coattail Rider Blues. You know, I mean, by the title you can tell it's music-based, but, you know, if you read it, as it even says when it's posted, you know, that was set to the rhythm of Roadhouse Blues by The Doors, you know?
Yeah.
So it's...
And there is actually, if anyone doesn't know Roadhouse Blues, there is a YouTube link on the page for Coattail Rider Blues on the Bycast website, so you can just... on YouTube, just click through, take a look, have a listen. You will appreciate the poem even more, or the song, the blues, this piece. You will appreciate it even more for knowing that rhythm. It's really well chosen, actually. I don't think I could have thought of anything better that would have fit it. But yeah, so I'm looking at that. Now, what I want to do, just for a second, is we've talked about your activism in general. You've got one piece of poetry today you've got one piece of poetry that I want to look at on, and I know it's on the Bycast website somewhere. And I'm just gonna have a look, because I know it's there because I've read it recently, where you talk about being on the outside of the LGBT movement as a bisexual, but still wanting to help where you can. I don't think I'm doing it very justice with the description, but I'm doing my best. It's quite difficult when you don't have it in front of you. Hold on. And yep, there it is. I've found it. We have a Start the Revolution Without Me, actually. So, being stuck. There was one line in particular, stuck in the worldly grind, learning how to live, and then later on you mentioned learning how to live part-time. I think that only just speaks to your particular situation that you're writing about, but speaks to the bisexual understanding and community as a whole, that a lot of us are accused of being part-timers, part-time gays or part-time straight, or however you want to word it. And that one in particular stuck out to me as being, again, like I said, you're very good at rallying calls, and this one stuck out to me. We actually posted this for Pride Month back in June 2014, so it's a while ago now. But, yeah. That's the beauty of poetry, isn't it? Anyone can read it, and it speaks to everyone who reads it personally, as well as with the intention that the poet had.
I mean, you know, that piece was originally written, like I said, I know you guys posted it in June, and the original inspiration of the piece, I was, I started mandatory overtime at work in June, and I was supposed to be at the Pride festivities in Indianapolis this year, in the parade. I was going to be marching with my Rocky guys. The Rocky cast is in the parade every year, and I thought, well, shit, I'm stuck here at work, so that was kind of the spark, Start the Revolution Without Me. But the fact that, it's being read as an inspiration, as the voice, as a rallying cry to the bisexual community as a whole, I mean, that's fucking beautiful, man. That's great.
What we're going to do now is we've had a good conversation, and I think that's a good place to end it with, giving you some feels about your own poetry. It's always good for the poet to feel good about their work. So I'm just going to wrap up now, but before I do, I just want to let the listeners know we will be providing links to pretty much everything that's been mentioned here. We will find something about the day of silence for anyone who's not familiar with that. Walter's going to send links for the album and the books. Watch this space. Don't know when Walter's going to get those to us, seeing as it's we're not quite sure when they're going to be released exactly.
Oh, and before we finish it up here, I also want to mention I recently started a new freelance journalism gig. I'm currently writing for the LGBT Pink Panthers movement. My first article was just sent to them. It's not up yet, but apparently, at least according to the editor, their voice of Baldy there as well. So check out the LGBT Pink Panthers blog and check out my work there.
We will definitely send links to the Pink Panthers blog so people will find you through there as well. And yeah, so I just want to take this opportunity now, Walt, to thank you for coming, to be interviewed. I know we've talked for a long time. We've been talking almost an hour now, but it's been fun. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have.
I have. Hell, I don't know about you. I could easily go for another hour. Yeah. I just don't know if your listeners could.
Yeah, exactly. But any, if they want to, they can get in touch anyway and let us know. You can always come back to this if you're free. But yeah, just before we're done now, I would like to ask our listeners to find us on GoFundMe. We are still very desperate for funds, which you will find links to that on the bycast. It's on the right-hand side of pretty much every page you click on. It's there, or it's at the bottom. So there is that. Would also, again, like to remind everyone who's listening, remember, you are not wrong, you are not broken, and you are not alone. You are a human being and you are bisexual, and we would like to thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed on the Bycast do not necessarily represent those of Bynet USA or the Bycast crew.